Then we have ABC also sending in a donation via Entropy, $10. Thank you very much. He says, what is the involvement of Soros's Open Society Foundation and its global branches in the recent race riots in France? Is this the same playbook as the BLM riots in the US in 2020 to 2022? Same directors, same playbook, different actors. Did anybody bother to follow the money? Well, I think it's a bit too early, I suppose. We'll have to wait for the dust to settle before we can investigate where is this all coming. I haven't seen anything, for example, like bags full of bricks left at strategic locations for Antifa to use or for BLM rioters to use, as we saw in the United States during the BLM riots. I think you're right to say it's copying the same playbook, definitely. I think the George Floyd riots, the Summer of George, has set a new precedent that people of minority demographics are going to use in Europe. This says we have seen various attempts. They didn't quite reach the level that France reached this week. But there was, in October of last year, an African named Alika was killed in Italy, and the black population in Africa, the migrant population, the left, the media, celebrities, all tried to turn him into an Italian George Floyd, basically. It didn't quite work. And this is what I addressed recently in a speech I gave in a Countercurrents conference, actually. I spoke about how Italy is this country that seems to have an immune system to this bullshit. It's weak. It's a weak immune system. Maybe it's coming out of dormancy, and that's why it's weak. But it does exist. It is there. And so this attempt to turn this African who died in some confrontation with an Italian, it didn't quite reach George Floyd levels. But I do think you're right to use that term, a playbook, and different actors, but same play. Woz, any thoughts on that?
I might put the cat among the pigeons here by saying that I don't think it was the same thing. And I'll say that I think you're right that the George Floyd riots, the BLM riots in 2020, did set a precedent. And that shows other people, kind of goes open source at that point, if you want to use that wanky terminology. They can then do it themselves. They can then just copy that tactic. But I don't think that's what... So that it opens the field for that kind of thing. But I don't think that the French riots from a few weeks ago, I don't think they had the backing of the elite in the way that the BLM riots had in 2020. I think I think those were orchestrated and desired, funded by, well, the BLM and all the corporations that fund that, all the organizations that fund that, no doubt advise BLM. None of that happened here, as far as we know. That I've seen no indications of that. What this was a spontaneous ethnic revolt against the majority French population. It was people who, they're bright enough to do this stuff themselves. You know, they don't need to be told. They're not. You know, they've not got an IQ of 75 or 80. They've got an IQ of 90, and they've got their own agenda, and they've got their own historical grievances that they're very aware of. Whereas with the blacks in America, they have to be told what their historical grievances are. I mean, they have to be told about Jim Crow. They have to be told about the Atlantic slave trade. They have to be told about the white man was bad to us in Africa. They don't know
anything. Feeding us to crocodiles, man. They fed us to crocodiles.
Yes, and they believe anything as well. That's the weird thing, that there's this tendency to believe the most ridiculous things. But anyway, I think the Algerians are really, it's an independent thing, as far as I can see, where they're, it's their own project to take over France, to literally, I don't think that's even an exaggeration. I think that they are thinking, we, the brothers, can take over France, and in time we will. And in the meantime, it's we can soften up the French by frightening them, by intimidating them, by showing them what we are, and what we're like, and that we're not afraid of them, and so on. So I think that's what was going on here. I don't think it was the rainbow regime, as you might say, with as it was with BLM, where it's really the. I mean, to me, there's a brutality about the French, right, the Algerians, but there's a sophisticated wickedness about the BLM stuff that I find even more frightening. I mean, at least with the Algerians, you know what you're dealing with. It's an ethnic conflict, straightforward.
Yeah.
With BLM, it's Microsoft, it's the Open Society, it's Pepsi, it's Exxon, it's BlackRock. It's all of this.
It's like you know, it's American. It's the American extravaganza. It's nothing quite on Europe reaches the American level of showtime. You know, it's like when America does it, you get the corporations in, you get the ESG scores, the banks, the everything. It becomes this massive thing. Europe is just too provincial, I suppose, to get to that level.
Well, I
would say, you know, George Soros and the Open Society, it's indirectly behind it, because George Soros and the Open Society has helped bring these people to Europe in the first place. But
exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yes. I don't think that it's as planned, as well-funded, as orchestrated as what we saw in 2020.
There was a whole political program waiting in the wings when BLM, you know, the whole thing with the statues, the works of art, the street names, all of that was clearly coming from above, and it was ready, it was waiting for this to happen, which of course makes you think that it was the event was precipitated by the elite. They just waited for an appropriate enough police incident to occur, and then they pressed the go button, and all of this was just ready. There's nothing like that here with the French riots. It's just Algerians doing their own thing, basically. Yeah. I don't see an elite coming down and making use of it, except in the most sort of lazy way, where they'll use it, like never let a crisis go to waste. They'll use it to demonize the native French and French culture, and just remind the French that they are racist and that their country is systemically, institutionally racist, and so on. But yeah, I don't think it was orchestrated. In fact, you could even say that it's not desired by the elite. And I don't know if that's true, but I have seen that said, that this is actually a disturbance for them. Like the BLM rioting with George Floyd served a definite purpose, like a definite metapolitical purpose for them. But this doesn't really. I think what they would want in France is just a continual, slow, gradual, peaceful replacement of the population.
I did ask this out loud as well. This was on my mind in a stream I did a few days ago about this with an Irish lad who used to go by the name the German Pointer. Now he goes by Betwixt on his new YouTube channel. But I said out loud, I wonder if in this case, when this sort of thing happens, if Macron is, you know, sitting in the Champs-Élysées face-palming and saying, oh, not again.
Yes.
The Muzzies and the Les Noirs, they just don't make my job easy, do they? Here I am trying to promote mass immigration and demographic replacement.
I'm trying to give my country to them, and they keep
exactly. You know, I'm taking pictures alongside shirtless blacks, all sweaty and hugging them, like that famous picture of him.
That is so
embracing
horrible.
These shirtless Africans that are like sweating. It's just so weird. He's sweating as well,
and he looks sort of entranced. Like he just can't believe his luck that he's got these muscular young black men wanting his company. I mean, it's just bizarre. It's like the guy who's won a prize at the end of a game show and he's not sure how to react.
One. There's another one where he's like sat next to one who's like wearing this weird fishnet bodysuit thing. All this weird. Anyway, so I was wondering, you know, if he's just left the Elton John concert and his phone's blowing up, and you know, he's thinking, oh, really, again. Oh, what am I supposed to do? What can I do to please these people and stop ruining my global homo dream world. I do wonder if sometimes the ruling class is face-palming and groaning, oh, not again. Because you're right, in America, that, you know, those riots happened during an election season, right before an election. They helped whip up a voting bloc that, you know, Trump had been appealing to in some small way. And so, you know, it served a purpose, as you said. The chaos served a purpose. Whereas in Europe, I think you're right, and I was wondering it too. I think the chaos might annoy the ruling class. And to the extent that they can use it, as you say, you know, don't let a crisis ever go to waste. Well, they'll just use it to increase the surveillance state, the authoritarian nature of the state. And ultimately, it'll be the native Europeans, in this case, the native French, who bear the brunt of it. Let's go to some comments here. Black Pigeon Pilled left a few tips over on Odyssey. He says, perfect stream guests. Thank you very much, Black Pigeon Pilled. And then he also has a question for us. He says, please discuss the potential breakup of the United Kingdom, specifically how this fits into the gargantuan term globalization, and whether or not this process would cease in the absence of raw American power. Thanks, guys. I appreciate this. Well, Woz, you've written a few Substack articles about the future of the UK and whether or not it's going to stay together. So I'll let you take this one.
Well, it's a different topic. I mean, I was not prepared for this, but I'll improvise. I think that in a different age, it would be good for the different countries of the different nations of Britain to govern themselves. I think it would be good because the empire's over. So we don't need Britain anymore as a constitutional entity anymore. It doesn't serve a purpose. I don't think it's good for us psychologically or culturally. I think it would be better for us to have Scotland and England. And I'm not saying this as some twatty Scottish nationalist who hates the English. I don't at all. I'm just speaking quite well. I think I'm speaking objectively here as a sort of bird's eye view of this. If that's not too grandiose. I think it would be better for us culturally to have Scotland as an independent country, England as an independent country, Wales as independent, Northern Ireland, I would imagine that would be best rejoining with the Republic of Ireland, but that's not my thing. I don't have a dog in that fight, and it's whatever the Irish and the Northern Irish want, I'm happy with it. It doesn't mean anything to me. It's not my fight. But these other countries, it would be better if they had their own thing. And in the case of England, maybe it would be best if England split up so that Cornwall was its own country, Yorkshire was its own country. Or maybe some unique arrangement where they're all the same country, but they're very much devolved. All of that, I think, would be good and healthy in a different age. In this age, everything happens under the auspices and watchful eye and the control of globalism and the rainbow. And so what would happen if this were to occur is it would be a case of divide and rule, divide and conquer, where you'd have these a collection of much smaller countries, each of which was much more vulnerable to a new agglomerating entity than it had been when it was part of the UK, the United Kingdom, Great Britain. It'd be much more vulnerable. All of them would be. England would be, Cornwall, Scotland, Wales. In which case, it would be very much out of the frying pan into the fire, because you'd have even more direct control of these countries on the part of the globalist entities. They'd be able to just decide that Scotland is now going to take in 5 million Africans or whatever ridiculous numbers they would decide on. And culturally, I think it would become even more globalistic than it already is. This stuff would just be pumped into these small countries. That's what would happen. And things like Scottish Gaelic and the Welsh language, I think those would be used as weapons to separate us from each other. So Scottish school kids, in a healthy age, Scottish school kids would learn Gaelic, and because that's part of their identity, and it would galvanize them, and it would nourish that sense of identity, so that nourish that sense of uniqueness in the world. But in this age, what it would do is separate them from the English and leave them much more dependent on the World Health Organization, on the World Economic Forum, on the European Union, and so forth. That's what would actually happen. It would alienate them from their natural allies south of the border. And so it's one of those things where in a different age, it could be really great. But in this age, it's not a good idea. So that's what I would say about the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then the part about America's influence. I think that if America does fall apart or lose influence or cease being the world hegemon, then all bets are off, basically, in terms of geopolitical change across all of Europe. Mm-hmm. So that's something that it's impossible to bet on or predict how that would play out. But I think that it would be the signal for a huge amount of change to occur. I think that America at this point is very much a stultifying agent in the world, certainly in the Western world. And that's without even going into the stultifying ideology of globalism and equality and so forth. I think that America in general it's not good for the world at this point. Certainly not for the countries of Western Europe. Now, that's not to say that, you know, I don't want to negate the fact that America has done some good things in the world. It's done some good things for Western Europe. Yes, that's true. I don't want to deny that. I just think that the time for that is over, just like the time for the British Empire is over.
Yeah. I'll just say briefly, my thoughts on this are that I think one of the best ways to oppose globalism is by embracing separatism and independence. I think a lot of nation states, several nation states, are proto-globalist anyway. I think the chaos, the disruption of the status quo would be useful. I think the right has made a mistake in ceding the entire terrain of separatism and independence movements to unsavory characters and leftist types. But I'm also aware of, like what you said, could that leave a small nation vulnerable then? In which case, I desire new alliances, new blocs to be formed. You know, if I think of an Italy that breaks away from the European Union, and then alongside it, Hungary and the Czech Republic and Austria do the same. I imagine a sort of Italo-Austro-Hungarian alliance. Things can change, things can develop. But as you said, there seems to be this stultifying stagnation and just nothing happens. Like I said earlier, we just have this, like the Michael Tracy mindset. We have to have liberal democracy. We have to have globalism. We have to have diversity on every corner of the map. And there's nothing you can do about it. Let me address some donations over on DLive. Mad Matt's 1478. Interesting number there. He donated 14 lemons. Thank you very much. Billy Free TX donated 20 lemons. So thank you for that as well. Okay, we're approaching 2 hours, so I wanted to ask you, Woz, and you kind of addressed this already, actually, so it's a good segue. This stultifying effect of the American empire, the fact that we do have this status quo where nothing seems to change, what do you think then? You mentioned earlier in the conversation, and I told you to keep that thought in mind, you mentioned, you know, the historical conditions that we have to wait. We have to wait for them to form. In order for there to be any change, in order for there to be any improvement from our perspective. So my question to you is, what do you think will cause those changes? What conditions do you think are necessary? And also, do you not think that this globalist system of liberal democracy, the American empire, as much as it might be wobbling and decaying, do you not find it incredibly resilient in that it already has evaded so many things that you would have thought would be its undoing, and yet it finds a way to absorb the controversies, it finds a way to absorb the chaos, the threats to its legitimacy, and just completely repress them, and then it doesn't even leave a dent, and then we all just carry on. So going forward, what do you think is going to be the conditions necessary for change?
Loss of comfort, loss of luxury. I think the only reason that people that the hegemon is so resilient is that it is able to offer people comfort and luxury. And if it ceased being able to offer that, then these things that happen would leave a dent in it, because people wouldn't put up with it. They wouldn't put up with bullshit stuff like diversity is our strength and all that, and diversity built Britain, all this stuff. So I think they're only putting up with that because they're comfortable. I think that comfort is the real cause of all this, which is a shame because I'm very much a creature of comfort myself. I'm not someone that claims, you know, cliff faces or, you know, does dramatic outdoorsy things like that. But, and I don't think that I would fare well in a situation such as I'm describing.
Well, let's be honest. A lot of us are going to be gardeners in the war rather than the warriors in the garden.
Yes, yes. But I think it's going to take that in order to change our societies. But fundamentally, what needs to happen is America needs to stop being the global hegemon, the world policeman, the hyperpower. Because, I mean, I've said this quite a few times, I think that if a European country, like, let's say, Sweden, if Sweden was gearing up to rescue itself, let's say, I think America would stop at nothing to prevent that from happening. I think America would nuke Sweden. I think if you had someone like Hillary Clinton in charge, or Joe Biden, I mean, who's obviously a senile husk, but I think that America would stop at nothing to prevent a Western European country from rescuing itself. And that's ultimately what I mean when I say it's a stultifying agent. It's also a stultifying agent in the sort of day to day, because it just prevents people from looking for alternatives. But
this is where I hear this again. I hear this from a lot of, like, you know, black pillars. You know, they'll say, Meloni can't stop the boats, because if Italy stopped the NGO boats, the American Navy, the American military bases that are all over Europe would point all their missiles at Italy. The American warships would flood into Italian waters, and Italy would be crushed by the power of the American Empire. And yeah,
they'd regime change Italy.
But do you think they would do that to a NATO member? And do you not think that other members of NATO would be like, wait a second, who are we? I think that that would actually provoke the kind of chaos that the system doesn't want, because you'd get other members of NATO saying, well, shouldn't we be taking Italy's side? We're Europeans. What are we don't want this American.
Yeah.
So then you'd have all this fracturing and chaos, which I don't think the status quo, the establishment, wants.
Exactly. America bombed Nord Stream, obviously. We all know it. It's obviously the truth. So, but that was able to happen, and all the other European countries and Germany put up with it because they're afraid of what will happen to them if they don't put up with it. They're afraid of America's military and economic, political might. That what could happen? If America weakens to the point that other countries don't need to fear its might anymore, then everything would change. And if America then tried to regime change Italy, I think you would get European countries starting to think, actually, we need to wake up now.
Whose side is America really on? Whose side are we on?
Well, I mean, exactly. And that's the question.
I think America wants European nations to start asking that question.
Yes, absolutely. But that's the question that everyone should have asked when Nord Stream happened. That should have been everyone should have asked, okay, so what America is willing to severely endanger Germany's economy, its wealth, its status as an industrial country, an industrial power, the industrial powerhouse of Europe. America is willing to do that. Then whose side is it on, and why should we be on its side, other than fear of the consequences if we turn away from it? Well, if you don't need to fear those consequences anymore, then you will turn away from it. That's what happens. So, again, I just keep coming back to this. I think that the key event that needs to happen is America needs to cease being what it is. And I don't know how that would come about. Maybe the war with Russia. Afghanistan, I think, could have been a portent of this. This massively powerful country ended up just walking away from Afghanistan. Now, even if it didn't have to, even if it wasn't forced into doing that, that's still a humiliating way for it to leave. So, a humiliating way for it to exit the stage. So, you've got to wonder why? Why didn't they make it at least look better for them, for themselves? You know, it's a strange thing to do. Because certainly the impression is
dysgenics, low IQs, dysgenics, incompetence is certainly affecting even the ruling class. That's what the Kali Yuga is. We're all tainted by this decay. It's a very interesting answer, a little bit unexpected there, Woz. Because I've taken some flack over the past year for saying things I've always said since I started, you know, being a public figure about these things in 2018. That I've always said about America, but I took some flack over the course of the past year, because when you do say these things about America, well, America needs to fall off its perch. America needs to kind of, you know, be undone in some way or another. A lot of Americans will get upset about that and will say you're being anti-American, or you're wishing Americans to die.
Well, I'm being anti-American, but that's because of America as a political entity. I have no animosity towards Americans. And, you know, I have fondness for America as a country, and especially for what it could have been and for what I think it was up until basically the First World War, maybe the Second World War, you could say. But I definitely don't have much affection for what it's been since the Second World War.
Right.
And what it is today.
I think there's an increasing number of Americans who are also now understanding this, and understanding that, you know, America is decadent. America is a danger, a real and present threat for the rest of the white world.
And for American, white Americans themselves.
Exactly. I mean, I've often used the phrase that wherever you are in the white world, whether it's in Ireland, Britain, America, France, live as if you're in occupied territory. Live as if you are, you know, a rebel in occupied territory, and an antagonistic regime has taken over, because that's basically the reality. But what I want to say was that what your response has reminded me of is the importance of calling out America and doing what we can to delegitimize the American empire and ridicule it and chip away at it. And that's why I always, you know, say to the Americans who get so upset, it's like, I don't have time for your complaints and your accusations of me being anti-American. Like, there's bigger things at play here than your sentiments of, you know, I'm insulting Americans or wishing harm upon Americans. I've had that thrown at me as well.
Look, I mean, do you think I don't have affection for the British Empire? I mean, but I do. And I like my country to be number one. I like us to be, you know, powerful and proud and all that, but it's over, and and it's like once the party's over, you've just got to leave. You've just got to go, because if you hang around wishing for the old atmosphere to return, you're just going to suffer. You're just going to suffer. You've got to move on. And yeah, America. Again, I don't say this with any hatred for it or animosity, and certainly not for American people. I like, for God's sake, some of my best friends are American.
You my know, parents still live in America. I mean, for God's sake.
Yeah. I don't have anything against them. I honestly tend to get on very well with Americans. And so, no, I don't hate them. But if you're asking me to feel some sort of kinship or affection for the White House, DC, Hollywood, no, you're barking up the wrong tree. And I think that you need to rethink your priorities. Why do you think that these entities care about you as an ordinary American? Absolutely not.
Yeah. Well, we've got lots of positive comments all over the Odyssey chat, all over the DLive chat. A user here called RMNALX, Remnalx. I don't know if you're supposed to say that as one word or just if those are initials. But he says, you guys should have your own show. Good stuff. Thank you for that. So we're at 2 hours. It doesn't look like there's any more.
Well, I did have some notes that I wanted to go through that I made.
Oh, please, go ahead.
But I can do it quickly, like, you know, 5 minutes.
No, no, I have no time limit here on my end, so go ahead, take your time.
Okay, good. This is notes that I made about the riots that I was hoping to integrate, but it went different ways, as it always does with live streams. So here are some things that I wanted to say. All right, when people say that this is what happens in France, or this is what the French do, i.e. they riot, that is, I guess it's something that people have, I've had numerous people saying this over the last 2 weeks, that, well, this just happens now and then in France. Now, to say that is to claim that this was done by French people, which it wasn't, it was Algerians. Or it's to say that the Algerians have literally become French and internalized a French custom of rioting, which is to say that they are integrated. Now, that's just clearly not true. So I think it's a complete misnomer when to say that this is just a French thing. It's not. I mean, it is when the French do it. But when the Algerians do it, it's for completely different reasons, and it's springing from a completely different nature. So I think that's...
Yes. I had someone on Twitter saying this, that the riots were an expression of the French spirit, because they said the French are rioting, you know, and this was someone, you know, saying, expressing their agreement, their allegiance, that they were taking the side of the French protesters. And I said, they're not French and they're not protesters. And he responded by saying, you know, they are French, and protesting is a part of the French spirit. And yeah, so he was saying all that. And then, you know, it was within a matter of like 5 other tweets that we just like completely dismantled this by saying, well, look, they aren't French. Look at the demography of them. Look at the videos. Look at the people who are participating. And because he was comparing that to the French yellow vests, the French protests during COVID. and I said, okay, well, then explain the demography differences. And also explain how it spread to Belgians and Swiss.
And explain why they're expressly moaning about France, the French, and French culture.
And if the people rioting are genuinely French and they're genuinely rioting about French police brutality, then why did North Africans in Belgium and Switzerland start protesting? What's going on there? No, it's because they aren't French. They were North Africans and Sub-Saharan Africans. It was an ethnically motivated riot with racial overtones, and that's why it spread to Belgium and Switzerland. And it wasn't native Belgians and native Swiss rioting. It was their co-ethnics that live in those countries as well. So again, yeah, it was just total delusion. That was a very tiresome take. That, oh, this is just the French doing what the French do. Vive la République.
Ridiculous. No. I mean, it's like you're saying it's just the Algerians doing what the French do.
But if you do believe that they're just as French as, you know, Chateauneuf-du-Pape wine, you have to believe that, oh, they're just doing French things, but they're not French.
This is an example of how stupid beliefs compel you towards other stupid beliefs. So if you believe that in civic nationalism or whatever, then you have to believe that these are French people doing just being French. It's just so stupid. So, okay, that was one thing I wanted to say. And then there's this quote from the Identity England article. Francois Hollande who's the former president, categorically stated that the problem is not immigration. And note how they, as you said earlier, they immediately moved to secure and insulate their core thing of mass immigration is a good thing, and therefore it has to be defended, and therefore it can't be blamed for this disaster. So anyway, instead, Hollande believes that all that is needed is a deepening of republicanism. French republicanism, which insists on equality of the sexes and demands a public sphere completely empty of all religion. And Hollande thinks that Muslims from North Africa want more of that. So yeah, it's secularism and race blindness. And obviously the Algerians aren't race blind. And obviously they don't want secularism. So what's going on here is, well, it's the elite wanting to secularize Islam, or they want secularism to cuck Islam. And so the question is, can that happen? Can secularism cuck Islam? Because that assumption is built into Hollande's statement. You know, he's presupposing that the Algerians are, and this is a big thing that I see quite a lot, he's presupposing that the Algerians are interested in the project of secularism and equality and multiculturalism. But those are white projects. Mm-hmm. Those are white dreams, white ideals. And I think that time and again, what you see from non-white minorities is that they're really not interested in these ideals at all. They will use them expediently for their own ends, but they're not going to pursue sec. I mean, if Algerians ever got the whip hand in France, France would not be a secular country the next day. You know, and it would
be pointed out by several commentators on our side of things that this idea of absorbing all these people and then integrating them or imposing upon them, you know, Western ideas, Western culture, egalitarianism, equality, women's rights, secularism—that actually is the definition of white supremacy. You are actually the people, the neocons who want this, are actually the white supremacists, because they're saying, well, our societies, our ideas, our civilization is so much better than theirs that we need to impose it on them, right? We need to paint rainbow flags on our bombs and then drop them on Syrians to show them, like, the superiority of our way of life.
Absolutely. It's this idea that inside every Algerian is a tranny just waiting to get this kind of thing. That they can be like us. We have to make them like us. And
we have to make them like us because we are better, because our way of life is better. Where, again, another bitter irony is that it's people like you and I who get accused of being white supremacist, whatever that even means. I mean, I don't consider myself a white supremacist because I literally don't believe in that word supreme. I don't think we're better than everyone at everything. But migration patterns seem to suggest that we are, because everyone wants to live in our countries. And neocons, conservatives, seem to think we are because they want to impose white culture, white civilization, white philosophy, white standards on everyone else, or integrate them into that because it would be better for the world, better for them. And so being a white supremacist is obviously a slur. It's obviously an insult. And so the bitter irony is that it gets thrown at people like you and I when we really aren't. We're the ones saying, no, look, people are different. They develop differently because of their environment that they evolved in and the cultures that they created. And race is a biological construct, and so society literally is the social construct. And we're saying, no, we want to develop our way. We want to continue our evolution, our development, according to our standards and our environment. And we don't mind if other people do it their way where they are.
Exactly.
But we don't have to mix together. And we get called the white supremacist. Meanwhile, it's the neocon and the conservatard and, you know, these diversity types who want everyone to be mixed up together and then just adopt some universalist global homo culture that seem to be genuinely, taken if you take it literally, supremacists in their ideology, at least. Yes. Very, again, just another bitter irony of Kali Yuga.
Yeah, indeed. I think another aspect of it is that it shows that, liberals really aren't. I mean, they go on about multiculturalism and how great it is, but you and I are actually showing more respect for the concept of foreign cultures than they do, because they necessarily trivialize foreign cultures by claiming that mm-hmm. they can all be integrated into a, you know, nice cuddly soup of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm.
And they reduce it to, you know, just the wide range of restaurants.
Exactly. This is what I was going to say. For them. Exactly. You know, for them, it's a matter of, well, foreign culture is just something that people do. It's trivial. And what I think is most people, it's rare for someone to actually be interested in foreign cultures. I think that in the same way that people talk about economics, but they're really not interested, and no one actually cares about the good of the economy, except the most fucking boring, autistic conservative. No mm-hmm. one else actually cares mm-hmm. about the economy. They'll use the economy and economic arguments to argue for the things that they want in other spheres of life, like well-being, culture, psychology, whatever it is. But they actually don't care about the economy. In the same way, that they don't actually care about foreign cultures. No one, like very few people, actually take any interest in multiculturalism, as I've said, other than the range of restaurants. So it's literally just novelty sensation seeking. Well, I can go to a Thai restaurant on Tuesday and a Chinese on Wednesday, whatever. But other than that, they really don't care. And what they want, therefore, is for these foreign peoples with their delightful foods to just forget about all that fucking backward nonsense from, you know, back home and just become like us. Mm-hmm. You know, bring on the recipes, but none of the other baggage. But they can't say that openly. So what they have to say is, yeah, bring it all. Bring all the baggage from your exciting, exotic foreign culture. I'm fascinated by it. When actually they think it's fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. And that's the truth. They think it's fucking stupid and unnecessary and silly. In the same way that they think our own cultures, our own traditions are unnecessary and silly. But they'll say that, you know, they'll belittle and mock native European things whilst pretending to think that the equivalent of a Chinese guy or an Arab guy is fascinating. Well, it's not fine. See, again, the amount of lies that we're living under, you know.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
And also what happens too is when the diversity manifests itself in a way that goes beyond just, you know, a falafel stand or a Chinese restaurant, well, it ends up actually completely undoing the liberal project, because this has happened, you know, multiple times, but most recently in Michigan, a town in Michigan, or I suppose a city in Michigan, has become like majority Muslim.
Is this about LGBT?
Yes. And so this once white Midwestern town full of white Protestants, basically, well, over time, they have been demographically replaced. And the city council is now comprised, so the ruling class, the decision makers, are now mostly comprised of Muslims with migrant backgrounds, or, you know, second or third generation Muslims. And well, what have they done? What did they do in the month of June? Well, they decided, we're not putting up any pride flags. We're taking down all the pride flags. We're taking down all the Troon flags. We're not having any of it. And it's permanent, not just for the month of June, not just for Pride Month, but permanently. No displays of rainbow flags, of trans flags, none of that. And so, of course, the liberals feel betrayed. And they're saying, well, we welcomed you in, and we respected your values. And now that you're in charge, we just don't feel like that respect is being reciprocated. And we feel betrayed. And it's like, well, you've done yourself up by your own petard. You brought this upon yourselves. Your experiment doesn't work.
Yes, because culture actually is meaningful. It's not just a funny costume to try on.
Exactly.
Like Justin Trudeau with his endless different costumes. I think that's so symbolic, you know, because yes. He's this guy, he's globalist, post-racial, post-national, And so cultures to him are just literally just costumes to try on. And I think this is how your archetypical liberal would like cultures to be, where they're just novelties and they're a bit of fun. It's like a Halloween costume.
I get the sense that it's like it's like that student who wants to take a gap year and travel the world, but now it's that instead of traveling the world to see the world, they just want it all to come here so that it's not such a long journey. And of course, what does the student who's taking a gap year want to do? He wants to try the food, talk to the people, maybe learn a different language, see some things with his own eyes, like, you know, and that's fine. You know, that explorative spirit, that adventurous spirit. But what these liberals want is that, like you said, it's all commodity, it's all convenience, and they want all of that culture to come closer, to come into their own country so that it's, you know, instead of having to travel the world, I'll have the world come to me. And I can, you know, walk outside and see all these different peoples and try all this different food. And oh, I hear all these different languages and it's so enriching and exotic. But then what they don't realize, or what they realize but, you know, don't want to admit, even when you have, you know, these clashes, it's that culture goes beyond just, you know, food and apparel. And not every culture blends, as I said, that the Gaulle quote, you know, Arab and French culture is like oil and vinegar. You mix it together, but it always separates.
And also it's onerous. It's actually difficult to learn about other cultures. You know, what it amounts to, what it ends up happening is that you learn some trivial factoids about, you know, how someone from Sri Lanka, you know, the Sri Lankan culture, that this they actually do this on Wednesdays. Oh. Well, now, how fascinating. Yeah. And what can I do with that factoid? Not much. But it was nice meeting you, and I love the food. And that's really what it amounts to. I mean, it's that shallow. But it's actually very hard work to learn about foreign culture. That's the point.
And then the result of all of this is that everywhere becomes the same. There's this meme. There's this quote that the smug midwits always say to us is, the cure for fascism is travel. Well, not anymore, really, because everywhere's the same. And actually, in my case, you know, it was traveling that revealed to me the importance of ethnocentrism, ethno-nationalism, that revealed to my own eyes what was going on demographically and helped shape me into who I am now. So, and I think that's true for a lot of people. So that quote, that meme is just so ridiculous.
Oh, it's completely the opposite.
Even more so nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if I traveled more, I'll put it this way. The only thing that allows me to maintain what blissful illusions I do have about foreign people is that I haven't met that many of them in their own cultures. And I think if I'd done more traveling, I might have an even more world-weary attitude towards them than I do, which is saying something.
Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't traveled in the third world, but I know people who have. And, you know, some of them are more open about it. Others admit it maybe after they've had a few pints. But they always say the same thing, that, you know, traveling in the third world made me realize how different we are and how good we have it and how, it, you know, it doesn't come easy. We didn't get here, you know, through luck and the ease. It wasn't easy to create the societies that we have. And you go to the third world and you see the difference and you see how they live. And it's a culture shock for sure. But then what's happening in the first world is that, well, now everywhere's the same. Germany is not very German. France isn't very French. And why? Because it's all, you know, peppered with multinational franchises and corporations, and the people are all the same. And the only thing that's really different is the language. They speak German in Germany. They speak French in France. But apart from that, everywhere's kind of the same. Like I said earlier, it's more like an airport nowadays. So the only difference really now is you have the third world and you have the first world. And these smug midwits don't want to go to the... They're not talking about the wonderful pleasures of third world life, you know? And so that's why they want it to come to them. They want African food to come to them so that they don't have to risk anything by going into Africa themselves. And then you have the naive ones who do, you know, like those Swedish girls who went hiking in Morocco and ended up getting
that was
a very grim fate. So there is that naivete on their side, but yeah, the consequences of their open borders world, of their shallow diversity, is that real diversity ends up being completely eradicated.
Yeah, definitely. And there's more that I could say about that, but I won't, because I'll move on to the next note that I made. The riots are a symptom of a segregated society, and so there will be calls for more integration. That touches on numerous things that we've already said, but it's ominous, and I don't like it. But, you know, I also think that, to return to that quote from the oil and the water, however much you integrate them, it still won't work. It won't take. Because you're just dealing with fundamentally different peoples here. The next thing was a BBC article.
I just want to mention too one note on that integration thing, because this gets thrown back at us, you know, because they will say, well, especially you are from Britain, so they'll say, oh, the Anglo-Saxons and the Celts and the Britons and the Picts, they all integrated and formed an ethnogenesis, and we're all immigrants. And they'll say, or they'll throw it at me as an Italian, oh, the Italians are, you know, the Northern Italians and the Southern Italians and the various Europeans who ruled Italy. So what's it even mean to be an Italian? Clearly integration works, because Europeans have been integrating other Europeans into their nations and their modern nation states for centuries. Okay, Europeans have been doing that. It's very interesting when I will say that an African, for example, isn't Italian. Don't call him an Italian. He's an Italian citizenship holder. He's an Italian passport holder. But do not take my identity and steal it for yourself, you African who's now demanding that I call you an Italian. And they'll say, well, what about Napoleon? Is he French? Well, he was from Corsica. Or what about Cleopatra? She's considered Egyptian, but she was Macedonian. And I just say, look, at no point did you mention any Africans. You mentioned other Europeans. So you unconsciously know that Europe is a race comprised of various nations. And you revealed it yourself by listing other Europeans. At no point did you cite a black man as an example of a European. And what's so interesting is that just a few months ago, I watched an interview with Thierry Henry, who is a famous French, quote-unquote, footballer, but he's black. And, you know, you would think that he's been well-integrated. He's always behaved very professionally. He's, you know, he's a great idol.
Charles de Gaulle.
Exactly. He's another Charles de Gaulle. You know, he scored lots of Charles de Gaulles in World Cups and things like that. So he's beloved, he's famous, and he's, you know, well-dressed and well-behaved. So you think, oh, here's a perfectly integrated black, you know, African descendant, migrant descendant, Frenchman. Well, in this interview, he was asked, what's his favorite film? Go ahead and take a guess what his favorite film is.
I'm guessing it wasn't Zulu.
It's The Color Purple.
Oh my God.
And you know why he said it was his favorite film? Because it spoke to him as a young black man.
Oh.
So they will always be apart. It's easier for a German to integrate into France, or for a Frenchman to integrate into Germany. And we've always had, I've said this so many times now, it's just so repetitive, that we've always had Frenchmen living in Italy, Italians living and working and building cathedrals and making paintings in France, Spaniards living in France, Brits living in Germany. You know, amongst the Isles of Britain, we've had a lot of interchange and exchange. The people who live there are all basically genetically very similar. But when you start adding in completely different races like Africans or Arabs, well, now the integration is much more difficult, because there's a lot less in common. We actually have differences. It's okay to say that we have differences. And one of the main differences, of course, is aesthetic. It's a lot easier to know who is an African in France and who is a native Frenchman. And it's more difficult to know who's a Frenchman that might have an Italian father, or a Frenchman who might have a German mother, because we look the same. And so you know, there's all sorts of reasons why it's easier for Europeans to intermingle and integrate amongst ourselves. And then on top of that, when you have an identity specifically for Blacks that comes from Black American culture, or just, you know, they themselves perceiving themselves as other because of their aesthetic differences, but also the cultural differences, then you get someone like Thierry Henry, who's lived all of his life in France, who's a good, you know, who you would expect to be a good example of an integrated foreigner in France. And his favorite film is a movie about Blacks in America because it spoke to him as a fellow Black man. And that, I think, just, it's something that no one wants to talk about on the conservative, you know, normie conservative side. Michael Tracy doesn't want to talk about this, won't recognize it. But obviously, the liberals won't ever want to talk about this or recognize it. But it has to be addressed because it's fundamental to not only the Africans' identity, but also our identity and how we interact with each other.
Yeah, I think this is just one of these things that they will always find a way around addressing. That they'll say, well, that's just one person, you know, or who knows what life experiences he's had. Or maybe on a different day of the week, he'd have said a different film, you know, Die Hard 2 or something. And it'll just be endless nonsense like that, because the issue is so fundamental. I mean, identity, group identity is just innate. And I think that, you know, this gets you to the matter of race mixing, miscegenation, because it's ultimately the only way that you can separate someone from their genetic inheritance, is to obliterate that link, which leaves them completely as a deracinated consumer. And I think that is ultimately the goal. I think that's what they want. And I find it completely monstrous. Mm-hmm. Just monstrous. And for everyone, I mean, not just for the whites, you know, it's cruel to create someone who has no identity except as their individual identity. But someone needs to know what they are before they can work out who they are. You know, it's a thing, it's a process. And some people manage it, it's not that big a deal, but for most people it is. And certainly when you're talking about massive numbers of people, well, then there's nothing for them to integrate to except rank consumerism, which is nothingness. Mm-hmm. So, I agree with you. I agree with you. I'll move on to the next thing. Oh, yeah, so there's this BBC article that said that the riots were fueled by everyday discrimination. And that was written by, and this is interesting, actually, based on what you just said. It was written, this article was written by a Canadian guy who now lives in France and writes for the BBC, but considers himself an Algerian.
Wow.
So when I say that he's a Canadian guy, I'm obviously speaking tongue in cheek. This is who the BBC, and this is a good example of how awful the mainstream media is now, that they chose this guy to write an article about this matter. I mean, you would, and I'm sorry, I know it's an obvious point to make, but you would never get an article on the BBC website written by someone from, you know, Generation Identity or something like that. It would never happen. So their side of the story is completely ignored. You'll hear only from an Algerian. And I guess the BBC would defend that by saying, well, don't you want to hear the perspective of the rioters, the people rioting? After all, they are in some sense Algerian. So isn't it right to get an Algerian to it? But then that gives the lie to the whole thing. You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, why? But anyway, the point I was going to make was that they said it was fueled by everyday discrimination. So it's as you said, it's white people's fault. It's the French. The native French, they've been discriminating. I mean, without even going into the history of the war with colonialism in Algeria and all that, even since then, the French have been racist towards Algerians living in their midst. And so this is just disgusting of the French. And so no doubt, no wonder these riots happened. And the least the French can do now is accept their villainy, accept their culpability for this. I mean, you know, it's like white people are just being psychologically abused left, right, and center at this mm-hmm. point by mm-hmm. every power center in society. And yep. the BBC, you know, I just hope that it is dismantled soon. But somebody commented under that article when the TBG shared it, and someone said, fueled by everyday discrimination, it won't be long before they are described as discrimigrants. Which I thought was amusing. And then French politicians refusing to recognize that it was about race. Numerous French politicians have said that. We've touched on that. Civic nationalists and center-right types blaming Islam instead of race. And I don't think that's black and white, no pun intended. I think that Islam does play a role in this. But ultimately, even that...
For the Arabs, it seems to me it's the Arabs who will speak more of Islam. The blacks are just, it's pure race grievances. I don't often see blacks saying anything about Islam. That tends to come from the North African Arab population.
Yeah. I can't remember ever hearing a black guy talking about, you know, jihad or whatever.
That's not to say that there aren't black Muslims in France. There are. It just seems to be that's not what sets them off. What sets them off, I think, is racial grievances.
Yeah.
As is ever the case.
Indeed. And then Macron saying that video games and social media are when he got back from his Elton John concert.
Yeah.
And that is obviously an incredibly stupid thing to say. But at the same time, the riots did die down once the social media was frozen. You know, once they did this, I don't know what it was they did exactly, but they basically seemed to cut internet access in any area that where a riot started. They cut the internet access there.
Yeah, that's something that we didn't get into. Even, you know, conspiracy, put your conspiracy hat on. You know, Elon Musk, at the height of these riots, I think it was the second or third day, they're all over France. They've spread into other European countries. Everything's on fire. I mean, France is a big country, so you know, you could be in parts of France where nothing was happening and you're just like, what's everyone talking about? But you know, in various cities, things are being burned to the ground, there's clashes with police. And so you're having all of this stuff going on. And then conveniently, and curious timing, Elon Musk decides to debut this new policy that now there's going to be data limits on Twitter. And you can only read a certain amount of tweets depending on if you're Twitter blue or if you're a new account. And I am a new account because I had to create a new one recently. I don't pay for Twitter blue. And I hadn't used Twitter all day. This happened on a Saturday. And I'm usually out of the house all day and not even have access to my phone on Saturdays. So I hadn't used my phone. I hadn't used the Twitter app all day. I log into Twitter for the first time, and within like 20 minutes now, it says there's an error or data limit reached. And I was like, what? Really? And I couldn't see anything. Even my own profile was just got that message, error, data limit reached. And that has not reoccurred since. So it seems like even Elon Musk, even Twitter, made this decision, whether because of pressure from France or it was just a very curious coincidence, but even Twitter was like shut down more or less for a moment. And people, French Twitter users were saying in response to Elon's tweet announcing this, our country is going through riots right now and this is going to be a horrible decision, a horrible policy, because we won't be able to follow what's going on. And that does seem to be the effect that it had. You couldn't see what was going on. And what really tickles my curiosity is that I haven't gotten an error data limit reach message since, now that the riots have simmered down. Very strange.
Yeah. But the other aspect to it is this why the riots simmered down? And they went on for 6 nights. And to some, I mean, you know, people said this with the Arab Spring in, I think, 2010 or 2011, that it was the social media that enabled it to happen. And could it be the converse of that here, where you switch off the social media and that sort of starves the thing of energy? I don't know.
Well, I recently listened to a debate between Reg Johnson of Countercurrents and Gregory Hood discussing ethnonationalism or imperium. And one of the thoughts that I came away with, because I'm on the side of ethnonationalism, as I said, I'm on the side of separatism and all that. But one thought that has really stuck in my head for a long time now is that even if we did create a world of, you know, hundreds of white ethno-nations, ethnocentric nations, ethno-states, we do still live in this globalized world. And the thing that really connects us all is the internet and social media. And so I think any ethno-state would have to do some sort of authoritarian measure and keep out social media and have like its own intra-social media network, kind of like what China does, I suppose, because the social media is a vector for this degeneracy and for, you know, for chaos in this case to spread. The internet really, and technology in general, really is this leviathan. And I think, you know, when you talk about ethnostates or separatist movements or how do we chip away at globalism or detach from the system, social media has to enter into that conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is one of those things where I think normies just don't really need the internet. They shouldn't have it. If only there were a way to categorize people who are intelligent and responsible and sensible enough to handle having access to the internet. You know, I don't think that some simple local girl should have an Instagram account because it enables her to become an insta-thought. Mm-hmm. I don't think that some naive young guy should be able to learn about communism and LGBT and all the rest of it.
Right, exactly. That's what I was just saying.
Yeah. So
TikTok, and TikTok is, from what I understand, just this vector for LGBT and particularly trans poison. And I also recently saw that on Instagram, there's this huge network of pedophiles using Instagram.
Yeah, I heard about this.
Yeah. And so, like, I don't have an in-depth understanding of it, but I am aware that the TikTok in China itself is very different from the TikTok in the West. And in China, TikTok doesn't promote LGBT stuff. It promotes science and cultural pride. And, you know, the algorithm promotes positive things, patriotic things.
Broken branch and ancestor cry and all this kind of stuff.
Whereas the TikTok algorithm in the West promotes all this degeneracy. And, you know, so we have to live in the modern world, and technology is just, it's part of it. And so I was thinking, well, any ethnostate then, any independent separatist movement that breaks away from a, you know, a global homo proto-globalist nation state, breaks away from the UN, whatever, the EU, any state in America or group of states in America that break away, secede from the union, well, they're all going to have to address the social media problem, because you can be independent, but once your people log on to an app on their phone or log on to the internet and they see a bunch of propaganda delegitimizing your state or still pumping out the degeneracy that has corrupted the state which you seceded from, you're still in the same place. You're going to still be fighting the same fights.
Yes. Yes, I agree. It's a very difficult, thorny question. My solution is, as with many things, actually, I think you have to talk about the normies, the hoi polloi, the masses, and then the other people. And I think if you separate like that, things become much easier. If only you could. That's really the thing here. I think if only you could do that, then I think a society would just be so much simpler.
I think you don't have to be so concerned about that, woes, because I was referring to the Chinese example. And again, I'm not the most informed about what China does with its social media apps and platforms, but it seems like China's not restricting the internet from certain people who don't have the IQ to use it. They just, the Chinese state, and I'm not simping for the CCP here, okay? I don't want to hear it. But it seems like the Chinese state just controls what's on these social media applications. Certain content isn't prohibited. Certain words aren't prohibited, perhaps, you know? And so anyone can use these social media platforms, but they're just not going to see, you know, TikTok videos on how to take hormone blockers.
Yes. You know? Yes.
That's just not allowed on that platform. And, yeah. You know, Elon has alluded to this where he said, you know, this isn't going to be allowed on Twitter. This content isn't going to be allowed on Twitter. This word, I think, you know, I don't know if it's real policy now or if he was kind of jokingly saying it, but a few days ago he said that the word cis is a slur and it's not going to be allowed on this platform. So it just, again, it's a question of who's elite. Who is in power? Who has power, and how do they wield it? So that's what I was trying to say is that in this conversation of, well, America needs to collapse, ethno states are the future, ethno nationalism is the future. Okay, all well and good. The demography is important, but we have to live in the modern world. As much as that might be a drag, and it can be, and being in the modern world means living with social media technology. And so any new nation state that's ethnocentric, detached from the globalist satanic cabal, you know, they're going to have to address this social media question and say, okay, yeah, we have set in law that the population needs to always be 95% ethnic whatever, but also we need to have a government program addressing what is visible on social media and what is not permissible.
I think one thing is the adverts that are shown. I mean, you could do this like with Twitter, for example, without censoring the actual tweets. You just censor you dictate which adverts are allowed to appear in your country. So there'd be nothing for, you know, hormone blockers or whatever, and mixed race relationships or whatever. But that would be one way. That would be one way. But yeah, I'm getting tired, I've got to say, because we've been going for nearly 3 hours.
Yeah.
So do you mind if I just get onto my last note that I wanted to
go ahead? And then I'm going to address a few more tips and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. So this is the last point I wanted to make. This occurred to me just after the riots sort of calmed down. I thought, if after this, France continues allowing Algerians to migrate to France, what better evidence could you want that something is seriously wrong? Like, so, I mean, or what better evidence could you want of insanity or malice, whatever you want to say? In other words, if after this France continues bringing Algerians in, how can that be forgiven? How can that be written off as naivety or they just didn't know what they were doing, etc.? This has been a very visceral demonstration of what happens when you have X number of Algerians in your society. Therefore, if you increase that number, if you bring X plus 1,000 or X plus 1 million Algerians into your society, you must expect more of this. Why would it? I mean, I guess that they would say, oh, no, actually, the more of them there are, the more stable and secure they'll feel here. So the less likely they are to riot. That might be their rationale. But that's obviously stupid. It's a massive, even if it did play out, it's a massive gamble to take.
And it still leaves no benefit, no explanation of what is the benefit for the native French people if more keep coming in.
No, of course
because
not.
Because these populations don't work. They're not filling labor gaps. They barely even vote, the people who live in the banlieues and behave this way. There's absolutely
detached, checked out, ordinary society. Yeah.
There's no benefit.
But the reason I said this, I made this note, is that we all know that France is going to allow more Algerians to move there. It is going to, I mean, there will be more. There will be no moves to, from now on, we're going to be more selective in which Algerians we allow to move here. No, it will continue just as it has been. And that is emperor's new clothes territory, where they're just in a state of either denial or delusion about the reality of the situation.
Or malevolence, again.
Or malevolence.
I cannot, you know, put that off the table. At some point, yeah, you know, it's incompetence, it's naivete, it's stubborn, ideological.
This is why I said denial, because they're yeah, you know, malevolent. But as for naivety, I don't think you can say that anymore.
Exactly.
How can you now be naive about what it's like having Algerians in your society? They've been there for 50 years or 60 years, and this happens. So you mm-hmm. cannot say you're naive anymore. That excuse is.
I suspect, and that's why it was good of you to read. It was good of you to read those statistics about the damage and the cost, because I suspect what the regime and the media are going to do in the coming days now is just memory hole this, and then whenever it comes up again, they'll just minimize it and say it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad.
Yeah, and people might well buy that because you know, mm-hmm.
Oh, they will.
Are very short. But mm-hmm. the other side of this is, if after this Algerians continue migrating to France, what better evidence could there be that really life there isn't very bad for them? So that undercuts their whole thing about France being a racist society. You know, if it is and it's so bad and you feel so out of place there, then why are more of your kind migrating there? To be
it's the famous meme, the let's go be oppressed meme.
Yeah. So in both instances, whether it's the elite allowing it or the Algerians doing it, the riots should undermine their arguments. Because I know,
and again, this goes back to the man in the Algerian sitting in the outside drinking his coffee, being asked questions by Ezra Levant. Ezra Levant, well, he's you know, doing that thing. He's complaining about all the French racism and oppression and discrimination. And Ezra Levant asks him, "Well, if it's so bad, if France is so racist, why do you come here?" And they just turn on a dime. It doesn't even register in their minds. The hypocrisy and the contradiction, they just turn on a dime and immediately say, well, actually, no, it's because they colonized us and now this is us taking our vengeance.
Right, yes.
So on one hand, it's we come here, we just want a better life, and then we get so mistreated by the racist French. And then immediately once they're asked, well, if it's so racist, why do you come here? And if you are so proud and patriotic of your original country, why do you come here? And then immediately it's, well, actually, no, we're not here for a better life. It's because we're here to take revenge for colonialism or whatever.
Yeah, so it's quite funny, really, because they're saying, I'm here and the French are racist towards me. And then once they're asked why they stay, then the answer is, well, I'm here because I'm racist against the French.
Yeah, and also so, I've been saying to people on Twitter when they say this, I've been saying, do you know that you're unwittingly saying that you are such awful people that your very presence amongst us is a punishment?
Yes.
That's basically what they're saying. We want to come and live amongst you because we know we are awful and we know that our presence deteriorates the quality of life for you. Imagine that.
Remarkable.
Imagine thinking of yourselves like that. It's
we
such a
walking...
self-own, but they
yeah.
don't.
I mean, it's like they're saying we are a pestilence.
Yes,
we're a nightmare, we're a curse.
Because they're not coming here they themselves are saying, we're not coming here to improve your life. We're not coming here to build infrastructure or railways or, and now I guess in the modern world, you know, startups or new tech or something. No, we're here to annoy you. We're here to frustrate you. We're here to punish you.
We're here to colonize you for in eternity. You
know,
in moments of rare honesty, it'll be like that. It's that overt. I mean,
astonishing.
Yeah. What is there to say about that? It's just completely crazy. And at no point does the matter enter the argument of what's in it for the native French.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that just doesn't come into it. And that is, I think, a sign of profound societal dysfunction or ill health, that mm-hmm. the native core ethnic group just doesn't factor in except as fodder for various policies and the grievances of various newcomer groups. Well, that's not fucking good enough. That's not, sorry, I'm sorry I keep swearing, people, someone said in the comments, but that's not good enough. And it's not a sensible way for any society to be run. Because if your society doesn't work for you and your the majority ethnic group, then what is the society for? What's it for?
Yeah.
I mean, why does it exist? Just to help other groups? Well, that's stupid. That's a silly. What? Imagine a species that only existed to facilitate other species.
It's like ridiculous. It's like we're the reverse then of the parasite. You know, the parasite tries to latch itself onto a host for its benefit. But imagine a species that invited parasites. Please live off of me, parasite off
only,
of me.
Yeah, only live for them. It had no other purpose than to serve as a host for parasites. You'd think it was the sorriest life form on Earth.
Yeah, exactly. But,
and that is not what we should be. That's not what the French should be. It's not what the Italians should be, or the Germans, or the Brits. It's ridiculous.
Okay, let me... I think we'll finish right on 3 hours if we can get through these tips quickly enough. Michael57DE sent in $5 over on Odyssey. Thank you so much. And he says, oil and water can be mixed, but they require a nonstop input of energy to remain mixed. Different white ethnicities can be mixed, and once mixed, remain without further energy input. Well, right. And that's basically when that process is given enough time, and I don't know how much time is required, but I do believe it's probably around a couple of centuries. Well, we call that ethnogenesis. And it helps that the people who undergo that process of ethnogenesis are as similar as possible. So you're right that it can happen. And that's why I cited, you know, the various European examples. And of course, this has happened in the Asian continent and on the African continent, that people, you know, nearby tribes intermingle and form a new nation. You know, Malaysia, for example, is an example. But when you start bringing in completely different peoples, well, then you're at the oil and water level, and it's too much effort for nothing really that benefits.
Yeah,
I think the juice isn't worth the squeeze.
Yeah, I think the matter of energy in that analogy is useful, because you could talk about, so these different elements can be made to merge or mingle, but only as long as there is energy being expended on making that happen. I think in the same way, if you got rid of the diversity propaganda, you'd very quickly find even white people starting to think, what are we doing here? What's the point of this? Why are we living coexisting? When we don't like them, they don't like us. We're not comfortable with them, they're not comfortable with us. So it takes this constant pressure of propaganda and conditioning to keep it just to hold it together, let alone make it work functionally.
And this isn't our opinion. You know, there's the famous book Bowling Alone, which documented how racially and ethnically diverse societies deteriorate in America and cause lack of cohesion, lack of civic participation, voting, things like that. The New York, before this was completely taboo, the New York Times wrote about this phenomena and wrote a positive review of the book Bowling Alone. So there is actual empirical and scientific analysis of the effects of multiracial, multicultural societies, and they're not good. The results have been evaluated and they're mostly negative by every metric. So it is worth asking. And that's why the regime has to repress this topic and pass hate speech laws, because once you do talk about this openly, you realize, like what you said, people realize, well, this isn't worth it. This isn't working.
Yeah, exactly. It's not working. And this is self-evident as soon as you take off the blinders, as soon as you just allow people to perceive the situation honestly. It's clearly a dysfunctional situation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. And then, last one here, a tip from Do Not Despair, $2 over on Odyssey. And he just says, great show, guys. This was excellent. Well, thank you very much, Do Not Despair. I'm glad you all enjoyed it. Again, thanks to Millennial Woes for coming on and guest hosting with me. Thank you to Greg Johnson for inviting me to be the guest host. I always love chatting with Woes. He has great perspectives, great ideas, very insightful. We all know this about you.
Well, thank you. So do you, though. It's always fun talking to you.
And you can find Woes, of course. He's back on Twitter. And also, he has recently started a Substack, which is very good as well. He's publishing essays all the time. Told me you have something like 50 essays in the works.
No, it's 90. it's grown since we last talked. Yeah, there are two.
Some of them we've talked about, and I'm waiting for you to publish them because we actually even did a stream on one. I don't even think you've published that one yet.
No, no, I haven't. But yeah, the, it's like it's two a week just now, but it'll return to one a week shortly.
And they're all very good. The latest one, Arium Blues, that you posted on your Substack, very good. A lot of us will have heard it all before, but it's still very insightful, and that makes it worth. And it's written in a way that is very shareable to your normie friend at work or to that conservative who's on the fence and you'd like to wake up just that little bit more. And we talk about the power dynamics and elite versus the hoi polloi. And I do still think that it's only ever a good thing to have more people on your side. Whatever the merits of populism or the shortcomings of populism or the delusions of populism, to quote Academic Agent and to paraphrase his title of his book, it's still just always a net benefit to have more people on your side. So a work, an article, or an essay rather, like the one you've just wrote, is very good for that. Again, just another apology for the late start and the technical difficulties that I had at the beginning. I hope that wasn't too much of a nuisance. I hope you all enjoyed this conversation, this edition of Countercurrents Radio. And we will be back, I think, next Saturday. There will be another edition. So tune in for that. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Millennial Woes, once again.
And thank you. And thanks to everyone for watching. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks to everyone who donated as well. Thanks to everyone who sent in questions on all the various platforms. Thanks to our moderators, such as Reed Johnson, always doing a legendary job, moderating all the chat forums on all the platforms. So again, thanks to everyone. Take care. Have a good night. Bye-bye.